Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of the call. If you'd like to ask a question during that time, please press star then one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to turn over the meeting to Amy Fricke. You may begin.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to today's webinar. My name is Amy Fricke, one of the organizers for today's call. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services, Division of Mental Health, and the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. The title of today's webcast is Effective Utilization of CRSS Professionals, Part 4, Program Sustainability. You will hear from a panel of speakers today. Before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few helpful tools and housekeeping items for the online portion of the forum. If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number you just dialed in at, which is 1-888-677-0056. The passcode is Illinois. Again, that number is 1-888-677-0065, passcode Illinois. Visual portion of the presentation is web-based. Of course, you can choose the audio portion only, but if you would like to log in to see the webinar presentation and PowerPoint, the login information is located on the invite you received after you registered. If you are experiencing any problems with a particular link to join, you can also go to www.joinwebinar.com and enter the web ID number, which is 498-180770. Again, that number is 498-180770. There will be a designated question and answer portion towards the end of today's presentation as well as in the middle. We ask that attendees please hold their questions until this designated question and answer period. The operator will then open up the lines for you at that time. And lastly, at the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take you less than 5 minutes to complete, and we value your feedback. Without further ado, we will now begin the formal presentation, and I would like to turn the call over to our first speaker for today, Mr. Bryce Goff, the Director of Recovery and Resilience. Bryce?
Thank you, Amy. Welcome, everybody. We're excited to have you with us for part four of this four-part training series on the effective utilization of Certified Recovery Support Specialists, or CRSS professionals. We're really celebrating today because today is the fourth and final presentation in this series, celebrating not so much because it's over, but because we've got so much great information sort of under our belt together. We've really appreciated all the interaction that we've had over the Q&A times. And now these PowerPoints that you've seen during the webinars, as well as audio content, are available online on our website. That would be www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com in both the consumer and family and the provider sections. So this presentation today on program sustainability can be expected to be up 1 week from today. And the remaining sessions or the completed sessions, professional training, complex relationships, and preparation and planning are already available on the website. So we're really excited to talk about program sustainability today. And really what this is about is building your recovery support program in a way that it lasts and is built to withstand the test of time. I'd like to introduce to you our presenters today. I'm very glad to have Nanette Larson on the line with us from the Division of Mental Health, Director of Recovery Support Services. In addition to Nanette, we also have myself. My name is Bryce Goff, and I am the Director of Recovery and Resilience for the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative for Access and Choice. And then finally, we have with us Trinda Hedges, Peer and Family Support Specialist, also with the Collaborative. So it's great to have our presenting team on board with us. We'll also be having two special guests join us for the question and answer sessions later on, and they'll be introduced more formally at that time, but that's Patrick Hayes and Jordan Litvak. So now I'm going to talk with you about the objectives for today's call. Participants will learn about some sources of funding for CRSS services. Participants will also learn examples of Rule 132 services that can be billed for by recovery support specialists, and also how staffing affects sustainability. Other things we'll be learning on today's webinar include examples of ways to measure recovery support program success, where CRSS staff might be most effective in your organizational chart, and finally, how to use collaboration with other organizations to increase your agency's program sustainability. Now, we know that you may have questions about these aspects of sustainability that we've mentioned just now, and we are going to do things a little differently today, pausing for some question and answer right after the financial section. So we encourage you to write down your questions as we speak, so we can all be ready for that portion of the presentation, which is coming fairly shortly. So the first piece of our presentation today is on program sustainability. In other words, how do we sustain a CRSS program? Again, how do we build the program in such a way that it will last? So for that section, I'm going to turn this over to Trinda. Trinda, welcome.
Thanks, Bryce. Well, sustainability is about more than just funding and financing. While funding is an important aspect of program sustainability, we also want to keep in mind how staffing, organizational placement, and collaboration enhances the success of recovery support programs. First, though, let's go ahead and talk about financial sustainability. Medicaid is the most obvious and well-known source of funding. We'll focus on how peer recovery support services are billed under Medicaid coming up on the next few slides. Other examples of funding sources for recovery support services include non-Medicaid fee-for-services, which provides funding for consumers who do not qualify for Medicaid but do meet other specific eligibility criteria. We also have the Title 20 grant and 708 boards where available. For a list of 708 boards, you can go to the Association of Community Mental Health Authorities of Illinois at acmhai.org and click on the membership list tab. Later in the presentation, we will discuss how to collaborate with other agencies. So if you missed the web address, it is going to be listed on the Where to Find More Information slide at the end of the PowerPoint. Additionally, the DMH contract managers are an excellent go-to source for questions about funding sources. Now let's go into more detail regarding Medicaid funding. Can Rule 132 be used to bill for services provided by CRSS professionals? The answer to that question is yes. Recovery support can and should be provided in conjunction with all comprehensive community mental health services. Medicaid Rule 132 has been designed to include elements of recovery support throughout. The most commonly used service code is Community Support Services. Infusing peer support into your standard program and billing codes is the right thing to do. The fact of the matter is that when there are separate billing codes and separate programs and separate offices, it creates an atmosphere of segregation and separation. Peer support is a valuable service supported by research as an evidence-based practice. Rule 132 is used by case managers, doctors, therapists, etc. It is quite fitting to also use it to bill for recovery support services. So with that being said, some examples of activities that can be billed under Medicaid Rule 132 services include community support, which encompasses individual, group, and team, psychosocial rehabilitation, or PSR, assertive community treatment, commonly known as ACT, and crisis intervention. The most important aspect of billing pertains to documentation of services. In order to receive Medicaid reimbursement, the service must be listed on the treatment plan and the notes must reflect the service provided. Otherwise, the payment could be considered unsubstantiated. So, for example, let's say that a CRSS professional goes out and does a home visit, and while they're at the consumer's house, they help them do some cleaning. So if the CRSS professional simply notes that on this date the service provided was cleaning the house, that claim is most likely going to be unsubstantiated. However, if the professional notes that while cleaning the house with the consumer, they focused on problem solving, budgeting, how cleaning can be part of a consumer's wrap plan, and you know some of those services are listed on the treatment plan, then the Medicaid claim would be substantiated. So in summary, it is not enough to just assume the services provided will be funded through Medicaid. In order to effectively sustain a peer support program through Medicaid, the documentation must reflect a particular service that can be billed under Rule 132. So there's a myth that recovery support specialists will not be able to bill at the same level as their coworkers. But the fact is that we've seen data from different mental health centers around the state where the recovery support specialists were actually the highest biller in the organization. I recall a time recently overcoming the assumption of some who did not think recovery support specialists would be able to bill at the same level as their coworkers. Then we saw data from a mental health center where the recovery support specialist was actually the highest biller in the organization. It is hard data like that which enables systemic change. So if you subscribe to the myth that your agency cannot afford a recovery support program and that hiring a CRSS professional costs too much money, well, this fact really debunks that myth. An effective recovery support program can and does sustain itself. Many centers have found an increase in both effectiveness and financial viability of their recovery support programs when CRSS professionals provide both individual and group peer support services. Some examples of individual group activities might include recovery education, teaching an individual one-on-one about the foundational principles of recovery, perhaps doing some mentoring and goal setting, housing, educational support, and you know maybe some one-on-one wellness coaching, like encouraging the individual to take personal responsibility in his or her recovery process by taking action and doing what needs to be done to get well and stay well. Some of the group activities might include the Kansas University Recovery to Practice Workbook, maybe some group information on SAMHSA's 10 Components of Recovery or the 10x10 Wellness Campaign. You might want to incorporate Wellness Recovery Action Plan or WRAP classes, as well as WRAP Aftercare Group. So in light of all this information concerning financial sustainability, it is easy to see that the fact is that CRSS professionals are not only providing grant-based services, but are providing integral, billable services that complement the services of other mental health staff. So I know that was a lot to take in. We really want to hear your thoughts and questions concerning this, you know, the financial aspect of sustainability, concerning funding, how you can fund for your recovery support program. So Nanette, would you please formally introduce the guests we have on the line before we ask the operator to open up to our question and discussion period here midway?
Thank you, Trenda. It's my pleasure to do so. I'm actually, you know, very excited to have the opportunity to introduce Jordan Litvak and Pat Hayes. Both of these individuals work for the Division of Mental Health. Jordan Litvak is the executive director of both Regions 3 and 4, and Pat Hayes works as the regional recovery support specialist for Region 4. We have actually invited them to participate specifically today to assist with responding to your questions both now and also later in the presentation, particularly in regard to aspects of sustainability, but right now in regard to financial sustainability. We decided to include them in this presentation because of the expertise that they bring in this area. But I want to just mention that we also decided to pause at this point in the presentation for questions that that you may bring to Jordan or Pat, because they have particular expertise that they have brought to the table because of their work with a variety of Title 20 grant recipient agencies that are working on peer support programs. They actually, I think in many ways, have become experts in helping to shape, support, and nurture recovery support programs all across the state, along with Tom Troe, who is the Region Recovery Support Specialist in Region 3. Pat, Tom, and Jordan are the co-facilitators for a peer mentorship learning collaborative that has been in operation for more than a year, I believe, working with the many programs across the state, not just those that receive the Title 20 grant money, but also many other agencies that have recovery support service programs up and running in some way or another that are interested in learning from other agencies and other programs. The group, the Peer Mentorship Learning Collaborative, meets once a month by teleconference with any staff that are interested in learning from each other regarding recovery support programs. And then there is a second call that also meets once a month, 2 weeks after the other call, that is only for the peers that work within those agencies. So they really did develop a wonderful collaborative learning arrangement by teleconference for agencies all across the state, and have thereby really developed expertise all across the state, but probably also develop their own expertise. So, again, I specifically asked Jordan and Pat of Region 4 because Jordan oversees these Title 20 agencies, and there are several of them in that one region. So I would like to welcome Jordan and Pat. We want to open the line for your thoughts, and you see on the slide here that we've actually asking you some questions in addition to any questions that you may be bringing to the line to ask us. So I want to review those questions real quickly here. We'd be very interested in you sharing with us and anybody else on the line examples of the sources of funding that your agency has used for recovery support programs. Obviously, we've listed examples of funding in this previous section that Trenda reviewed, but you may be using some of those examples. You may be using examples that we did not list, and this is one way to learn from each other. So if you would be willing to share how you are sustaining your program financially, that would be useful and helpful to others that have come to this training program today. And then secondarily, what examples of services do your recovery support specialists bill under Medicaid Rule 132? It's probably likely that whatever you're doing regarding billing, you may think that it is obvious. Like, why would I say that, or why would I share that? But the truth of the matter is that, just as Trenda reviewed in her section, that there are many program agencies that have called me or contacted Jordan or brought it up on the Learning Collaborative that they're kind of in the dark in this area regarding billing. And so by your sharing in this area regarding how it is that you're billing in recovery support services, you would really be helping others who have called in for this training. So we're kind of drawing in our audience to help be presenters in some way right now. So obviously, we also are opening the line for you to ask your questions. That's why we've brought Jordan and Patrick as experts to respond. Obviously, Bryce and Trenda and I will be willing to respond as well. We're probably going to lean heavily on Jordan and Pat in this area. So what questions might you have for us about financially sustaining and or billing for the work of the CRSS staff? So with that, we're going to go ahead and turn it back to the moderator to direct you. Thank you.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name.
Okay, we'll wait just a moment here for some questions, and we're looking forward to hearing what you all have to say out there, both your questions for us and your thoughts on financing recovery support services. So we're looking forward to your questions and comments.
Okay, our first question comes from Courtney. Your line is open.
Oh, hi, I'm Courtney calling in from Turning Point.
Great. Nice to have you on.
Hi. Well, I'm really glad to be here. I was able to take part in part one, and I thought it was fantastic. We employ in our living room crisis intervention program three recovery support specialists. We call them peer counselors. Currently our program is grant funded, though we're looking into billing under Rule 132 in the future. We would mostly be billing for crisis. My question may be a simple one, but it's all of our peer counselors are college graduates. They're working towards a CRSS credential but haven't been able to earn it quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, just as I bill as an LPHA because I'm licensed, would they bill as MHPs or RSAs, which is something, a designation I've seen but in the crosswalk but know less about?
Yes, thank you for your question. So
does that make sense?
It does.
Oh, terrific. Terrific, because I'm super clear on the billing codes, but I wasn't sure about the MHP piece.
Okay, great. And I think I heard Jordan's voice on the phone. Jordan, are you there?
Yes, I'm delighted to be here. I think this is a great call and a great series. And those of us, I suspect there are a number of people on the call who listen in to the learning collaborative calls, either the peer-only or the all-staff call or both. And if you haven't ever joined in the past, please do so in the future. In fact, we've got a call this week on Thursday. But to answer Courtney's question, you know, if you are already a CRSS, you can bill as an MHP. If you have other qualifications, if you're college a grad with a degree of experience, I believe you may also bill as an MHP. Otherwise, you'll have to bill as an RSA.
Okay.
Thank you. Great question, and I appreciate the response, Jordan. You know, I think you brought out a really great point within the context of your question, Courtney, which is that currently your program is funded by a grant, but you're looking into the future into how you may be able to bill Medicaid for that. And I think that's really great forward thinking in terms of sustainability. And so kudos to you for that. Good planning there.
Yeah, I this is Jordan. I do too. I think any agency looking to hire a peer specialist or a peer mentor, we always advise that as a part of the hiring process, if the person doesn't already have the CRSS, that become a clear expectation upon hiring. Because really, if you talk about sustainability and financing of these programs, the greatest expense at this stage of the game, at this level of development and of peer services in Illinois, is really the training process that peer mentors need to really be effective. And while you're going through extensive training, you're not always able to bill at a significant level of productivity. So obviously, if you're able to hire directly CRSSs with background experience certification, that's wonderful. If they're in short supply, they won't be in a few years, but if they're in short supply in your area, the sustainability and financial pieces really require an agency to make a commitment to the training of the peer mentor and the supporting of that individual for the CRSS.
Thank you very much. Moderator, we're open for another call.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1.
Okay, we'll give it a couple more moments here to see if anyone else would like to dial in with a question. Thanks, moderator, for the instructions on how to do that. I think I really appreciate Courtney's courage in stepping out and sharing a little bit from their program. You know, I look at this as an opportunity to you know, to be able to, you know, share about some of the great things that your agencies out there are doing, because, you know, I think the Peer Mentorship Learning Collaborative is a great example of, you know, what better source of learning than from each other. So thank you.
Bryce, if you don't mind, I could make a couple of other comments about funding and financing, if you wish.
Sure, that would be great.
Yeah, I believe Trenda mentioned the variety of ways that programs are funded. They could be either through a Title 20 grant when the next round is coming up. That will be for 2014, so that's a year and a half off. There's also 708 boards, enlightened 708 boards who wish to support peer services. And I think agencies need to be encouraged about hiring peer mentors in a particular kind of way. A lot of agencies will say, well, you know, show me the money before I make a hire, which, you know, under this day and age, I think that's not an unreasonable approach. But another approach also is for the agency to make an investment in hiring someone who's a peer counselor who eventually will become a CRSS. The agency is making an investment and is also making a statement about what they believe in and what their mission and vision is. And in this kind of investment also promotes the possibility of agencies being more desirable by other funders and grantors if they already have a pre-established peer mentor program up and running. And we saw that in one of our agencies, Human Resource Center in Paris, Illinois, where the chief executive of that agency decided this was the right thing to do. We're going to build it, and they will come. And it's exactly what they did. He took money out of their own reserve. They hired their peer mentors and subsequently were able to have a grant awarded to them for the work, because when the grant application was looked at, it was seen that this agency had made a significant commitment to peer services, which made giving more money for program expansion and the likelihood of success even greater because of the agency's commitment.
Well, thank you, Jordan. Moderator, do we have any more questions at this time?
Yes. Our next question comes from Cheryl.
Welcome, Cheryl.
Hi. This is actually Meredith, but I'm with Cheryl. And I just had a quick question for you all. We currently have an employee here at our agency who is a family resource specialist, and her two children are both have mental health issues. And what we were wondering, would she qualify as a person in recovery, not necessarily her, like, personally, but through her children, would she qualify for this position if she were to go get her CST program here, if she went and got her CRSS?
Thank you so much for your question. And for that, I'm going to turn this over to Nanette Larson.
Hi, Meredith. This question has come up several times, and it's one that I appreciate responding to because of its complexity. The wonderful thing right now is that the Children and Adolescent Services Division of DMH has worked very hard and now has their own credential for persons such as the family resource specialist you've mentioned, parents of persons with mental health challenges, and that's the CFPP, the Certified Family Partnership Professional credential, also through IODAFCA or the Illinois Certification Board. And I know that wasn't your question. Your question was if this individual pursued the CRSS. However, the CRSS credential is one such that you have to sign a statement saying that you can self-disclose that you are a person in recovery from mental illness yourself, meaning that this individual would not be able to genuinely sign that statement because
right.
She is not a person in recovery from mental illness herself.
Okay.
And the reason why we created the CRSS credential in that manner is so that persons would have a true peer, a person who's been there themselves. And in your situation, or the person that you have hired, she's a true peer to other parents, but she's not a true peer to persons who are walking their own recovery journey.
Okay, thank you, Nanette. That was very helpful.
You're welcome.
Great question and great response, yeah. Nanette. Thank you. Any other questions at this time, moderator?
No further questions.
Okay, great. Then with that, I think we're going to go ahead and move on with the presentation. So Nanette's going to come back on and talk a little bit more about sustainability through outcomes. Welcome, Nanette. Sustainability through staffing. Welcome, Nanette.
Thank you so much, Bryce. Yeah, this is actually a topic that I find of great interest right now, because through the many years that I've been doing this work, one of the things that I've talked a lot about is the value and importance of hiring more than one recovery support specialist. Usually when I've talked about that, I've talked about it in terms of the benefits to the person who's being hired. In other words, I've often talked about how important it is not to hire just one person, because then that person has to be a lone ranger and they don't have any peers, they don't have anybody around them to be, by their side to help support them when they're going through difficult times as being a person who's self-disclosed in the workplace. I've talked about it in terms of how valuable it is to the person served and how important it is that individuals who are receiving services can hear from different perspectives of persons in recovery. So, just having Nanette as the peer specialist, they only hear my recovery story, and then oftentimes they might think that if their story is not like mine, then they're not in recovery. But having just two even just helps people to see that there's more than one way. Mm-hmm. And even if it's just me and Bryce, and theirs isn't like mine or like Bryce's, they've already seen that there's more than one way. But one thing that never crossed my mind until we really got into doing this work, and I got to give Jordan the credit for helping me to see this, is that hiring more than one is not just about those things I just mentioned. Hiring more than one is really about keeping the program alive. If we're going to sustain this program over time, then really hiring one person is setting your program up in a lot of ways to not have a long life, because you're not able to have a successful sustainability if that one person moves on, which hopefully they will. I mean, the goal is progress, and the goal is that we, I don't plan to be in this job forever, for example, and that's not anything about this job. It's just about that, I plan my future to be progressive. And so hopefully they will move on. So I had a recent conversation with Bryce, and he had some great thoughts and examples about this. So I was hoping, Bryce, if you would go ahead and share that with those who are listening to this training today.
Well, thanks so much, Nanette. I'd be happy to. I look at recovery support like a team sport. Now, there are times when perhaps one staff could run the show. I mean, I've got some great staff on the team. Trinda on the call, Trinda Hedges, Sean Johnson, Sharon Grant are all just phenomenal recovery support specialists. But let's say we did just have one person running the show. What if that person leaves? Suddenly you have no peer support program anymore until a new person is hired. So transmission of vital information is lost, even in the best case scenario. So if we run recovery support like a relay race, where you have one guy running a certain distance, passing the baton to another, him running. If we look at it like a relay race, passing this baton from one to the next, how is the baton passed if we only have one person on at a time? Usually in the real world of employment, where one person leaves before another person arrives, one runner is going to have to metaphorically put down the baton, and the team will have to wait for a new person to be hired to pick that back up. But not only will they have to pick it up, but they'll need to be trained how to run effectively. So in my experience, this works much better as a team sport that's more like basketball, where you have more than one person playing on the court together at the same time. Now, of course, occasionally someone will need to come off the court. You know, maybe they're going on to pursue another line of work or advancement in their employment, whatever the case may be. And you put a new person in, but you still have the whole team playing together and much less ground is lost. There might be some adjustment, but the game won't need to be stopped and restarted. We won't need to relearn lessons that we already learned previously in the game. So I think that metaphor really helps me to see how much having a recovery support team is beneficial to the sustainability of a program. Thanks, Nanette.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good image. I like the contrast between the marathon with a baton versus the basketball team sport. I like that a lot. So we shared up on the slide a couple of things that other centers have found to be effective and helpful in, you know, thinking about sustainability through your staffing. Obviously, the one we've been striking here is hire more than one person. I'm not really usually in favor of part-time positions, but at the same time, I think it would be more favorable, and this is actually, again, me in progressive learning, because I, probably in the past I would have said one full-time, but I think now I've come to understand why it's more favorable to hire two part-time than it is if that's what you have to do and that's all you have the resources for, than it would be to hire one full-time. Because if you lost the one, the other would still be there to keep things moving while you get that other position filled. Number two, make sure you have clear job descriptions and expectations. We have talked about this in the context of previous webinars, but talking about it in the context of sustainability, the importance in this context is understanding that the person who is being hired on and sharing their knowledge, you know, we may think about the telephone game, and if through the telephone game is the only way that the new persons are learning the duties, the duties may become far from what you had originally intended if that's how your staff are coming to understand what their expectations are. And so making sure that your intentions as a supervisor, manager, director are clear on paper from the get-go so that when new staff come on, they have that same format to follow each time. And then I think the third one is probably the most important. Training the other staff within your organization to work together with the new recovery support staff. This really is critical to program sustainability. I have to say that through the years, I have been really in awe of the resiliency of persons who've been hired into these positions within agencies where the culture has not yet been transformed to be a recovery-oriented culture. Individuals have sustained what I would consider, in many cases, workplace abuse from colleagues who do not quite get what it means to be working with persons who have self-disclosed in the workplace, and they don't have to go through that. So if we train our staff organizationally to become more recovery-oriented, we're going to have more success in helping persons to not feel like, I'm here, but I'm only here until I can find something better because this I don't really have to put up with this abuse, you know? And so really I think that recognizing that if we want this program to last over time, that it's not just the program itself we have to look at. We have to look at the overall organizational culture for that to be effective.
And may I add something to that?
Absolutely.
I think it, you know, might help to talk a little bit more about the kinds of things that we might be talking about folks, you know, enduring, which of course generally is going to be unintentional on other staff's part.
Right.
Of course, you know, there's always sort of that bad apple. But, you know, I think probably one of the biggest things that I've seen is having lowered expectations for the person based on them being self-disclosed in the workplace, you know. One of our coworkers uses the terms, you know, handling them with kid gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that what's really important is to train other staff in, okay, what are these new recovery support specialists here for? What are they contributing? And how does that work with what you're doing? So that there's not a misperception that what makes these staff special is sort of, maybe a little bit of what's wrong with them, but what's right. And what's right is that they're bringing in a competency that's based on having lived experience that's going to add something to the team. So I hope that's helpful, just in elaborating.
Yeah, you know, and I'm so glad you did elaborate at that moment, because those points that you made reminded me that I think it was session three, webinar number three, that we did our entire webinar on the topic called professional training.
Yeah.
And the majority of that webinar was focused on the training that you would provide for the current staff, is what we were referring to, other than the recovery support staff that you might be hiring new. And those kinds of ideas that Bryce is just mentioning are available in MP3 format online, or also on the PowerPoint format online on the collaborative website. And so if you're kind of wondering, well, you know, what does it mean to train other staff to work with these folks? Does it mean that they need to understand what their diagnosis is? No. That's not at all what we're talking about. You know, we are talking about helping the staff to really understand, as Bryce is saying, you know, that we treat each other as equals. And there may be some nuances. When I was talking about, you know, things that might be somewhat abusive, you know, it is subtle, and it's certainly not intentional. To be subjected to listening to other staff talk about the person served in negative and derogatory ways can be very offensive to individuals who personally are in recovery, and those things that are being said can seem like, well, hello, that's me. And we certainly would not be talking about persons of color in that way in front of other, you know, I mean, so it's like you have to recognize that you're talking about people in front of other people, and you're talking about the same kind of people in front of people. And so, like, things that we may have become very accustomed to doing in the culture of our agency, we have to change those behaviors because of changing this in the culture of our agency, which is hiring people with these competencies to really bring that peer-to-peer expertise to the benefit of the person served.
And ultimately, that's only going to serve the persons that we're here for better.
Absolutely.
In doing that. Thank you.
I'm so glad you brought it up. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about sustainability through outcomes. In other words, how do we transfer hope into concrete outcomes to demonstrate and celebrate the efficacy of our recovery support program? We all know that we need to do this, but how do we do it? When we are able to show those sources that we're getting our funding from, and even our own boards of directors, the outcomes and impacts of our programs, we are certainly more likely to be able to maintain financial support. Certainly, I think this is a principle that most of us on this call already understand and apply in other areas, and so all we need to do is simply learn to and remember to apply it to our recovery support programs. So some ways that we may be doing that in recovery support would be through utilization of surveys, through demonstrated billing levels, or through quotes from persons served. So let's look at an example of blending hard data with quotes from persons served. Let's look at the data first. On your slide, you see some survey statistics that Bryce had shared with me from the Warm Line, which is a peer support by telephone program, which the DMH contracts with the collaborative to provide. The percentages on this chart, which are kind of small and hard to read, but nevertheless, you can see that they're very high, and I think that that's remarkable in and of itself. But the percentages that are on this chart represent average scores received from callers last year, corresponding to questions that the callers were asked about many aspects of the service provided on the Warm Line. What I love about this, though, is that it's not just about, for example, we served 347 people in the month of July, but rather it gives us more concretely something referencing, for example, 93% of the people surveyed said that using this service helped them to prevent a mental health crisis. Now that is an outcome. For the DMH to hear that the Warm Line is helping to prevent crises helps to support the continuation of the program and certainly helps us to make decisions about the coming year's contract. Then, when you see that data beside quotes that bring the data to life and give it a human voice, it is all the more powerful, as with the quote that is written here. So you see on the slide at the bottom a quote that's from one of the respondents to the survey, which says, "Talking to people on the warm line gives me hope that I will be able to overcome my challenges." So blending data and quotes or short stories in this way can help you to touch both the minds and the hearts of decision makers. This type of information contributes to the value of a recovery support program within an organization. Reports, brochures, and posters may all be good ways to tell everyone about the program outcomes. So we have talked thus far about financial sustainability. We've talked about how to achieve sustainability through staffing and also through demonstrating outcomes. So now I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Bryce, and he's going to be talking about how to utilize organization and collaboration to sustain our programs. Bryce?
Thanks so much, Nanette. Now, we've talked about financial sustainability and how to achieve sustainability through staffing and demonstrating outcomes, as Nanette just shared. So now let's talk about how organizational and collaboration in sustainability work. For greatest sustainability, consider where CRSS professionals fit best in your organization's organizational chart. Consider placement of a director of recovery support on the organization's leadership team, along other directors, which might include, let's say, a clinical director or a quality management director. And some of the value of that is to provide greater influence within the organization and to help create a career path for recovery support specialists as well. I'll ask a question here. Is there room in your program for recovery support interns? Depending on the nature of your program, that might be very appropriate, a way for you to get some extra support with the program and also be developing candidates for the future. So that's a positive thing.
And you know, Bryce, I know that Jordan already gave a shout-out to Human Resources Center in Paris, Illinois, but they actually just filled, I think, their first two recovery support, they call them peer recovery support specialist internship positions over there.
That's
so
awesome.
Yes, they're really quite a model program.
That's outstanding. And then what other area might benefit from hiring staff with CRSS competencies? You know, this just helps us to, you know, quote unquote, think outside the box. Think about what other areas in the organization could really benefit from the kinds of experience and knowledge base that CRSS professionals bring. And at one point in our organization, we utilized that for our complaints resolution process. We've also decided to go that route for another phone line we have called the Williams line. And it's been really beneficial to have people with the CRSS competencies, not only in one program, but sort of peppered throughout the organization. So continuing on with this concept of organizational sustainability, for greatest sustainability, consider where the CRSS professionals fit best. Make the recovery support specialist an equal member of the treatment team. I think this is really important in providing direct services. Not having a recovery support specialist as an equal member on the treatment team has been a pitfall of some recovery support programs where you have recovery support providing services throughout the day, but they're not on the team that gets together behind the scenes and talks about, okay, how can we help this person more, or how can we do things differently. Organizational considerations like this are vital for success. So I'm just going to ask the question, do your recovery support specialists go to the treatment team meetings? That's an important question to ask. And if they're truly an equal player on the team, it just makes sense for them to do so. You might consider placing recovery support programs and staff with supervisors who are ready to embrace and work effectively with CRSS professionals. So let's say that at this time it's not feasible for your organization to have a director of recovery support position. Well, then you're likely to place the CRSS professionals under a clinical director or someone else. But we would just encourage you to give some thought, you know, talk to your staff, see how ready they seem to be to embrace having people with CRSS competencies in the workplace. You know, just go with sort of the flow of what seems to work with the leadership, because there's nothing worse than having a leader who doesn't believe in the program running a program by people who do. And so you really want to find the right place to plug them in. Take care not to place CRSS professionals on sort of a paraprofessional level within the organization. And this kind of comes back to that comment that I made earlier. CRSS professionals are professionals, so they should be equal colleagues with their coworkers within the organization and not on sort of a pseudo-staff level, so to speak. So, in addition to providing direct services, consider how a recovery support specialist might be involved in other tasks, such as training other staff. You know, if you want your whole organization to come to embrace the vision of recovery, you know, what better thing to do than to involve people with the lived experience who are competent in providing services, training your staff on the foundational principles of recovery or person-first language or other techniques that are emphasized in the CRSS credential that can really help your organization to improve. You might also consider how CRSS staff might simultaneously provide new and progressive services on the one hand, which tie directly into the agency's mission on the other. So providing unique services that are distinguished from other staff can really enhance the effectiveness. We don't want to just put CRSS staff, let's say, in the case manager box. We want to use them for what they're best at and use their unique skill sets to provide something new to the organization. But at the same time, you have to tie that clearly to what the agency's mission is, so it's not sort of a fringe or outside program. What they're doing is directly tied to the mission. And I think, especially in times of budget constraints, that makes it easier to justify and support the program when it's clearly tied to the mission of the organization. So sustainability through collaboration. Collaboration, of course, is the art of working together. We would encourage you to connect with other providers who have hired CRSS professionals. This webinar has been one way to do that. I think the Peer Mentorship Learning Collaborative, in some ways, is an even better way to do that in terms of building those relationships and connecting. You know, I encourage you to request technical assistance from the Division of Mental Health Regional Recovery Support Specialist. These are experts like Pat Hayes, who we have on the line, and who will be with us for the question and answer session at the end again. These folks are working with a multitude of agencies at the same time that are all trying to do the same thing, and that's employ recovery support specialists, effectively develop recovery support programs. And so they've seen what's worked, they've seen some pitfalls, and they're there to help. And then you can also seek support from reputable organizations on more of the national scene, such as the National Empowerment Center or the National Association of Peer Specialists, NAPS. I just think we all do our work better when we're working together and learning from one another. You know, and I know that when developing a new, unique, progressive program, sometimes we kind of want to hold our cards to ourselves, you know, the proverbial Uno game or something, and at the end be able to shout, you know, Uno, hey, we've got the best program, you know, we did it on our own. But at the same time, while I understand that, I think it's humbling and it's a very productive process to intentionally learn from others who've gone before you. More on sustainability through collaboration. You can encourage staff to join consumer-run initiatives that are going on currently in order to share ideas and support. Here's some examples of some of those opportunities that exist now. The Regional Recovery Conference Planning Committees. So the DMH regions have recovery conferences that go on that are planned by a committee of persons in recovery. In other words, these conferences are sort of designed by people with lived recovery experience for people who are on the recovery journey. And so what better way to connect with others than to get involved in that process? And many people have found that they've learned lessons from their peers and also been inspired and motivated and gotten fresh insights for their work by being involved in that. There are also regional consumer advisory councils in the different regions. Sometimes they go by different names depending on the region. Consumer advisory councils, forums, but this is another opportunity to not only learn from peers, but to be able to give some feedback back to the Division of Mental Health. And finally, I'll just plug again the Peer Mentorship Learning Collaborative as a great resource for networking and collaboration. You know, so much of what we have learned that has contributed us to developing these webinars is from learning from you, those folks on the call who are really out there doing the work, and we want to thank you for that and recognize you for that. So thank you for your hard work out there and all the work that's contributed to the growing knowledge base of recovery support in Illinois. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Trinda, who is going to share where folks can go to find more information. Trinda?
Thanks, Bryce. Great presentation. You, Nanette, Jordan, wonderful information. So at this time, this does conclude the presentation portion of the training. We're going to have an opportunity for questions and discussion responses shortly, but first, I do want to take a moment to let you all know where you can find more information. The Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website, which is all one word, real long, www.illinoismentalhealthcollaborative.com, has an excellent section on CRSS resources. It is under the Consumer and Family tab. Much of the material used to create this presentation came from some of those resources. You know, financing, recovery support services, fact sheet, recovery through an integrated workforce, of course, employing persons with the CRSS credential, you know, several different scholarly articles and presentations from other organizations that have been able to effectively utilize CRSS professionals. Also, there's an excellent book by Jim Collins. It's called Good to Great and the Social Sectors. I'd highly recommend that as a wonderful resource. And, of course, as I previously mentioned in the financial sustainability portion of the presentation, if you'd like to find out what counties or where the 708 boards are located in Illinois, you can go to www.acmhai.org. We don't want to forget about the DHS, DMH Recovery Support Specialists. These RSSs are, you know, just an amazing source for questions, for feedback, to bounce ideas off of. As you know, we're going to hear shortly, Pat Hayes is on the line with us. He is down in Region 4. But first, we have up in Region 1, we have Virginia Goldrick. She covers Chicago and Cook County. Also, Marty Hines. In Region 2, over in the Rockford area, you can contact Eldon Wiggett. Also in Region 2, but over in the Elgin area, you'd want to get a hold of Patricia Lindquist. Region 3, which is the Peoria area, Tom Trow, of course, is your go-to person. Like I said before, Pat Hayes, he's over in Region 4, Springfield. And then down in Southern Illinois, Region 5, Metro East, you'd want to get a hold of Cindy Mayhew. And in the southern portion of Region 5, that would be Rhonda Keck. At this time, we are going to open our lines for, you know, a little bit more question and discussion time. And so I'm going to turn the line back over to Bryce to moderate that period. Really looking forward to hearing your questions and any suggestions or comments that you might have about this presentation. So, Bryce, you want to take it from here?
Sure, Trinda. Thanks. And thanks for all your hard work on these presentations. I know you were very significantly involved in the content development, so I just wanted to recognize you there, Trinda.
Thank you.
So, audience, now we want to hear your thoughts again. For questions and discussion, we'd like for you to consider responding to one or more of the following questions. First, in what ways do you measure success in your recovery support program? Maybe there are ways that you do that other folks haven't thought of, so we'd love to hear about that. Also, how are CRSS staff positioned within your organization? How important is it to you to have more than one staff person in the recovery support program? And, you know, we talked about this a little bit. I think, again, hearing from people who are out there, you know, doing the work is most valuable. So if you have an experience with that, you'd like to share either in, sharing a lesson learned or the advantages of having more than one person, you'd be welcome to share that. In what ways have you collaborated with other organizations to increase program sustainability? And finally, of course, what questions do you have for us on recovery support program sustainability? So with that, I'm going to hand it back over to the moderator to open the line for questions. Moderator?
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name.
Okay, and that was star 1?
Star 1.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're looking forward to whatever questions and comments you might feel free to share out there. To me, this is really one of the most valuable parts of the presentation is hearing from you. So we're looking forward to your input. Pat, welcome onto the Q&A. Is there anything that you'd like to share with the audience as we go into the question and answer session?
Sure. Thanks, Bryce, and good morning, everybody. I just think that I'd want to add, when you're talking about people, consumers, or peers getting involved in committees and things like that, and I think that's very important, especially for maybe agencies that are looking to hire peers or looking for recruiting peer mentors, because even for myself, the first time I participated in the decision-making process was when I joined my local NAMI. A local NAMI in my community, and they invited me after a few years to be on their leadership meetings. So as I sat on those, I learned how to be an advocate, but I also learned how business decisions are made. So what I'm trying to say is I think there's peers at every agency that are capable of sitting on committees, and they can make change happen when they're given, especially when they're given a chance. I know there's a lot of committees and lots of ways for peers to get involved, and I think sometimes if somebody hasn't worked in a while and they're a peer, they might feel anxiety to get involved with something like that. But committees and also the learning collaborative, I think it also helps people understand how committees work and understand the process. Thanks.
Well, thanks. That's a great insight, Pat, and it kind of brings to mind another point that as you're developing a peer support program, kind of in the initial phases, you know, why not put together a committee of persons served at the agencies to ask them what do they want out of this program? I think nothing could be more powerful than that and more targeted towards getting folks what they need to recover. So thanks for that, Pat. Moderator, do we have any questions or comments at this time?
Yes. Our first question comes from Judith Scott.
Welcome to the call, Judith.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I just wanted to make the comment about how definitely having more than one person is the practical thing, especially since I had been out of work for quite a while and Virginia Goldrick had been hired on while I was off of work. And then when I came back to work, the two of us, you know, worked together, and she's always been the person, whether I'm here or not, that gets the consumers on the statewide call-in. I think we have a real good record of that. And it's very beneficial to have another peer, you know, as a CRSS person to, you know, talk things over. And I'm on committees and she's on committees, and, you know, we share a lot of information. And the one thing, I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but we have a guy here, a consumer, who does discharge surveys, and now he's doing some social work things. And I don't know if other hospitals have these kind of people on small contracts. The bad thing about the small contracts is that they don't get paid. You know, this guy got hired like in June. He got paid like in July, and then he didn't get paid again until December. And I think that that's kind of a problem area, because some people get discouraged that they're, you know, they're doing the work and their money just isn't coming in. And it may add to the fact that they might want to, you know, might not want to stay as long as, you know, we would like them to.
Well, thank you, Judith. I think there's some really valuable comments on the value of having more than one person providing services at a time in the recovery support program. And also, to the point of how we set up the position and prepare for it can really have a lot to do with how long the person lasts in the position, and really giving it the same consideration that we would for any other professional position is very important. So thanks for your remarks, Judith.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Joyce Butler.
Hi, Joyce. Welcome to the call.
Hi, thank you. I'm from DuPage County Health Department, and actually the two consumers that I supervise had to leave to teach ESR classes, but they wanted me to give some comments and to ask a question, if that would be okay.
That would be terrific. Thank you.
We've had, and our title here is Consumer Specialist, but we are considering changing that title to Recovery Support Specialist. We are all in agreement that that may be the better way to go at this time. But we've had, since 1998, nine consumer specialists work as full-time workers here. So I agree 100%, and our consumer specialists agree as well, that it's best to have more than one person at a time, because there's been very successful within the agency hiring consumer specialists for different positions. And then outside the agency, some of our consumer specialists have left to take on jobs throughout the community. So I believe it is very important to have more than one consumer specialist as well. One of the concerns we have right now, three people who have their CRSSs within the health department. Two are volunteers, and one is a person who was a former consumer specialist who has now become a PSR staff member. The concern for our consumer specialist is the cost of the CRSS, not only in getting the licensure, but keeping it up year after year, that they feel that that cost is inhibitive for them to maintain. And I just wanted to get people's feedback on that, how maybe they have worked with the cost of the licensure and maintaining that licensure cost. Here at the health department, we do not provide assistance with any staff member getting licensure or certification and sustaining that certification, other than providing CEUs at times, you know, training. So if I could have any feedback from consumers on how they do sustain that.
Well, great. Thank you so much for stepping out with your questions and comments. I think there's a lot of content we could respond to there. A couple things I'm going to refer to Nanette on. One piece was you had mentioned how you're going through a process of looking at changing the titles of the position, and second was in terms of any assistance that might be available with paying the various fees involved in the upkeep of the credential. Nanette?
Yeah, I would like to just respond regarding the cost issue, if you don't mind, Bryce.
Oh, and sure.
Then either you can take it or take it back to Patrick or whatever you'd like. I just want to make sure for the general audience, Joyce, I'm sure you've got this straight in your head, but we're always careful with things like licensure. The CRSS is not a license, just for the general audience to hear that. It's a credential. The Illinois Certification Board doesn't do anything with licensure, so it is just a credential. The cost in terms of maintaining that credential, there is an annual renewal fee, and the Division of Mental Health has put money over at the Illinois Certification Board for scholarships specifically to help people to cover that annual renewal fee. And so anytime we have people who are struggling with the cost, that's the first thing I say is, if you haven't already asked for a scholarship application, or if you haven't submitted a scholarship application to the ICB, that's our response. You know, if people don't tap that money, you know, it's always a use it or lose it kind of situation with money like that. So we really encourage people to use the resources that we have sent over there. They're obviously limited. We don't have unlimited funds to help people, but we have put money over there to help people who can't afford the annual renewal fee. So I hope that that's helpful. They do, you know, I think that now for all CRSS candidates, when they send out the renewal letter, they send the scholarship application with the letter. They were doing that for a time. If they're not doing that anymore, just make sure that the persons at your organization are aware that they can contact the ICB for a scholarship application. Thank you.
Thanks so much. That's great.
Well, thank you, Nanette. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the title piece and maybe ask Pat to give his take a little bit, too. But you had mentioned that you're in the process of looking at changing the title from consumer specialist to recovery specialist, I believe is what you said. And I just want to applaud you. I think that that is great. Actually, in 2000, when I first started working in the field, I had a title of consumer services specialist. And when I was hired or going through the interview process, I had the impression that in calling it consumer services specialist, that I was a specialist in services for consumers. But in coming on with the position, I quickly realized that that was sort of at least in that organization, code for I am the specialist in being a consumer, which are really two different things. And so what we want to encourage is that folks aren't a specialist in being a consumer, but a specialist in supporting others on the recovery journey. And so we really like the title Recovery Support Specialist, and that's why we've used it within the credentials. So please feel free to do that. And that way it's the title is about the action, the work that they're performing, rather than more of a personal designation of who they are or what their experience is. So I just wanted to give you kudos for that. Pat, is there anything that you'd like to add about that piece of them changing the titles?
Thanks, Bryce. And first, I just say, Joyce, you said DuPage County has 9 consumer specialists, and I think that's great. And you might be, you know, interested in hearing more about the Learning Collaborative, too. If you're ever interested, you can contact me or, I think, Eldon Wiggett, where you're at. And the thing about the name, changing the title of the position, I just want to mention there's a peer support specialist in Paris, Illinois, that was recently invited by Jordan Litvak to be on an Illinois Suicide Prevention Coalition. So there's opportunity when you work as a recovery support specialist or peer support specialist, there are sometimes opportunities to advance. And so when I look at my personal title, which says recovery support specialist, I know that if I go you know, down the road, or if any peer specialist is you know, applying for a job or updating their resume, I think it's helpful to have a term that doesn't label me or label any other peers. So I think that's one reason why I like the term recovery support specialist.
That's a
good
point.
That's all I got. Thanks.
Great.
Thanks again for your questions and comments, Joyce, and thanks, Pat, for your response.
Bryce, this is Jordan. I have a comment about the affordability of the CRSS certification fee.
Great.
You know, I think this speaks to what you were talking about earlier relative to you know, organizational and administrative support. I think that agencies who hire CRSSs, particularly if they're hiring someone on a part-time basis, might be more difficult for them to afford the CRSS certification fee, and it's very generous, I believe, of the Division of Mental Health to make scholarships available, but those scholarships are limited as well. And I think agency administrators need to think about that in advance of hiring individuals on two counts. One, that when they hire someone for the CRSS position, that they make it clear, if it's their policy, that it's the expectation that that person find a way to be able to afford the fee. So that's one option. And I think taking pains in being able to address that up front with any candidate looking for a job at that agency, you know, provide some advance notice to an individual where they can save the money, put money aside, et cetera. The other thought that occurs to me is that in recognizing the sustainability factor, it may be in the agency's best interest to build in that fee as a part of the person's salary or benefit package. And that way, no one winds up in a crisis over looking for funds, that kind of thing. And it's another reflection of an agency's support of a recovery services mission. So I just wanted to mention those two thoughts.
That's a great point. Thanks, Jordan, for that. Moderator, do we have another question or comment in the queue?
Yes, our next question comes from Robert Darby.
Welcome, Robert.
Well, welcome, Bryce. This is a wonderful conference here. A short question. I was just wondering if you have any data on how the CRS are being embraced within the hospital and the private sector. I've worked in the different hospital arenas for quite some time, and I know several years ago there was a great push to get a CRSS professional on board to run after-hour NAMI groups and other types of programs, and I was pretty impressed with that. And also how important the recovery conferences are, too. I've participated in a number of recovery conferences in Elgin, and very important for information, learning, and well-attended, too. So those two thoughts on my part. Thanks.
Well, thanks so much, Robert. You know, first on the data within the private sector and hospital side, perhaps Jordan might have something there. I'll kind of continue on for a moment to give him an opportunity to think about that. But I would say, as far as utilizing people in certified recovery support specialist type roles within hospitals, I think it's important to realize that really the CRSS credential and what we're doing in mental health is a part of a much bigger picture in healthcare. And I recall when one of my grandmothers was going into treatment for cancer, one of the staff that they had on hand was either a cancer survivor herself or a family member of someone who really brought a listening ear, a lot of understanding, and helping a person navigate the whole process based on having lived through the experience themselves. And so I've seen that in the cancer realm. I know folks have seen peer support growing, you know, in the brain trauma recovery realm, MS, lots of different realms within healthcare. So really this is a part of a much bigger movement and seeing the value in employing persons with those lived experience to self-disclose in the workplace. So I think it's very valuable to hospitals and private healthcare organizations to have people in those roles. Jordan, is there anything that you'd like to say on his question about data?
Yes, I do. I have a couple of thoughts. As far as hard data, we haven't tracked that over time, but we are aware, at least in regions 3 and 4, that Blessing Hospital in Quincy employs or contracts with Transitions of Western Illinois, and the recovery specialists will go over there and do groups at the hospital. They've been doing that for years. It may be possible to talk to Blessing Hospital and get some data that potentially, if it's reasonable, to post on the collaborative website so people know about that service and how it's used. But I know they do RAP groups and other support groups, and this has been going on for some time. I believe also that a Methodist hospital in Peoria used to employ peers to provide groups. I don't know if they're still doing that. So those are two sites, one current and the other perhaps historic, that maybe we could yield some information from. And then if you don't mind, Bryce, I'd like to comment on the recovery conference process as well, because in regions 3 and 4, between Tom and Pat, they have done a fabulous job of engaging persons interested in recovery services, recovering consumers, onto that committee. And we look at the membership of the Recovery Conference Planning Committee as a petri dish, if you will, for leadership development of a person interested in providing services to peers. And I think there are a lot of skills that people learn and develop as a function of being members on committees and making decisions that would help them on their career path if they're interested in being recovery specialists, CRSs, and the like. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jordan. And Robert, we've pulled back up on the screen the Where to Find More Information section, and you'll see there that third bullet point. There's an article on our website titled Effectiveness of Peer Support in Reducing Multiple Psychiatric Hospitalizations. So I think that article could be a good resource for you as you continue to explore in this area. Again, our website is www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com. If you go to the Consumer and Family section and find CRSS, just click on that and you'll find the resource there. So I hope that that's helpful. Thanks so much for calling in with your question.
Great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Nancy Weed.
Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the call.
Hi. First of all, let me respond to who you might contact at Blessing Hospital in Quincy. And Chuck Johnson has been the person contacted with coordinates our peer supports, helping with groups over at the hospital. So that might be a source if you call Blessing Hospital, 217-223-1200, and ask for Chuck Johnson. So that might be help for people out there. Also, I wanted to just respond to the importance of having more than one peer support specialist, and also how and where they are within the organization, even working with their co-workers. We started out, I think it's 3 years ago, with one gal that was working part-time, and now we have three, two part-time and one full-time recovery specialist. And we started out a year ago when we added the two other people. We were in a different facility in our agency, and it was really difficult for the case managers to coordinate with the peer supports on a person's recovery plan and coordinating how they could be working together. We moved the peer supports to the same location this past fall. Not the ideal situation because we were kind of at different wings, but we did combine them, to work closer with the case managers. Also, we had two of them in an office by themselves, and just this past week, we were able to rearrange our office spaces. And one of the things that we did do is, with Alan and I as supervisors, ask the peer supports, where would they like to be? Would they like to be together in an office or mixed in with the case managers? Everyone said they wanted to be with the case managers. So we were able to make those arrangements and make that happen. So they're all moved in. And I think the idea that they're able to collaborate with each other so much and to help each other, really working to help our clients in their recovery, supporting the work that each of them are doing. And so that has worked great. We also have them in our staff meetings each week with our case managers. They just are very much a part of that. They share their wins with consumers. And also what we do is we have a meeting in the afternoon on that Monday with just the peer supports. They have also shared that they need the support of each other in their work. So they have the support of the case managers at a staff meeting in the morning, and then also individually the peer supports in the afternoon we staff with them. But also we ask for their input. Very much they come up with ideas for their recovery groups, any kinds of issues that come up. So it's really more of their staff meeting, too. So if I look at the best of both worlds. So I share that, what's been working with us at Transitions.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy, and we love the work that you all are doing there in Quincy. Would you mind if I read back to you Chuck Johnson's number to make sure that we have it right?
Sure.
Okay, so that was area code 217-223.
Yes.
1200.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's the general phone number of the hospital, and then if you ask for Chuck, that they can page him or send the person to his voicemail.
Great. Well, I think you brought up such an interesting point, and that's about sort of the full integration of staff on the team. And sometimes even just placement of location can make a difference. And I'm really in support of that. You know, one of the subtle language things that I see happening fairly often out there is referring to kind of our, while we have recovery support specialists on staff and we have clinicians on staff, referring to the recovery support specialist as sort of our consumers and then the clinicians as our staff. And really they're all staff. And, you know, I think we need to be really sensitive about while they have different roles, esteeming, you know, them as equal staff members. And I think what you talked about is just really powerful in asking them, what they would like their situation to be, whether they'd like to be integrated with the others or not, because that integration really benefits the person served, I think, when you have sort of that discussion ongoing between clinical and recovery. That's probably one of the most beneficial aspects of, you know, where I work is we have a recovery team, a clinical team, and they're co-located in the same offices and they talk to each other. And, we have two offices, one in Springfield and one in Chicago. And we kind of went through a similar process where we thought, well, should all of them, you know, be together in Springfield? There would certainly be advantages of that. You know, the team could all be together face-to-face. But we decided to very intentionally have some of the staff in each location. And I think part of the importance of that is to have sort of a recovery presence in the location, because those recovery support staff are going to pick up on things that clinicians might not pick up on, vice versa. And I think just having them there sort of lends a certain degree of accountability to the program. So thanks so much for sharing on that.
Bryce, this is Jordan. I would add, as reflecting what Nancy was saying, how that really parallels what we do with our learning collaboratives, and which is and the same with the collaborative as well, in recognizing that peers need their own time for support and professional development and professional identification, and that our all staff learning collaborative call and the staffing that Nancy is talking about, and it really reflects the level of integration within an agency or institution that makes the sustainability of such programs possible. I would go so far as to say that integration is a foundational principle of sustainability for peer support services.
Well, thank you very much. I think those are very important and insightful comments. Thank you.
So, Nancy, you've provoked, like all of us, to want to speak, which is a good thing. I bet Pat probably has something he wants to say, too, but this is Nanette. And one thing that I caught that you said that I really wanted to just highlight for the general audience, because I thought it was so profound, is just, you know, it really tying all of this back to, you know, like, what's the point? What's the point of, and it really made me, you know, really think about what's the point of all this conversation?
Yeah.
What's the point of doing any of this? And the point of doing whatever it is, whether it's moving the offices, you know, to being in the same space as the community support offices or whatever, you know, the point is making sure that we're providing the best possible treatment for the people we serve, and that we're continually evolving toward a more recovery-oriented system, which, you know, we're all learning and growing and understanding of what it means to be a recovery-oriented service system. And so what we understood, you know, a year ago when we started the program, or in the case of DuPage County, I think they started in the late 90s, you know, what we understood then is going to be different from what we understand now. And so we have to keep reassessing, and we have to keep, you know, re-looking at it and saying, okay, how can we do this different to make it better for the people we serve? You know, and I think what you said that really provoked that thought in my mind was when you said, you know, when the peer specialists are talking more regularly with the case managers, then the person served are getting better care. You know, I was like, Wow, that's the point of all of this, is making sure that the people we serve are getting the best treatment possible. So I really appreciated that comment.
Well, great point, and way to get to the heart of the matter.
Yeah,
thanks,
yeah.
Nanette. Moderator, do we have any other questions at this time?
Yes, our next question comes from Linda Harrison.
Welcome to the call, Linda.
Actually, this is Nancy Rood, and I was the one who had the question. I'm here with Linda.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks, Nancy.
You mentioned agencies might consider placement of somebody called a director of recovery support, and that's the first time I've heard of that, so I was curious about other agencies that might have that position in place and kind of what the qualifications are and the job description of that individual.
Okay, so what I heard you asking was, one, do we know of agencies that have such a position in existence currently? And then two, what kinds of qualifications you might expect for that type of position? So I think for the first part of that, about agencies that might have such a position or sort of a coordinator of recovery support services position, Pat or Jordan, is there anything you'd like to share there?
This is Pat.
Hi, Pat.
Hi. With the Director of Recovery Support Services, I just think that's an excellent idea, and I think the best part about it is if the director is supervising other peer support specialists, you know, for one thing they can do is the peers can go there with more complicated or clinical questions. The peer support specialists know who to direct their questions to, and a lot of times the peers can be trained better on things like ethics and responsibility, and it just helps to have a point person that the peers can go to, and also the director is often just seen as viewed as a leader. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Pat.
This is Jordan. Hi, Nance. We have, I'm aware of one other agency in Region 4 that's in the process of developing the rationale and job description for Director of Recovery Services. This would be the first time that they are doing it, and they are using the region to consult with. And we find ourselves, they have very good intentions, and we find ourselves consulting to them to make sure that that position is at a level where it's going to have maximum administrative impact to the agency. I think CRSS has got to be a given. A number of years of experience, perhaps as a recovery specialist in an agency or a similar kind of experience would be desirable, if not necessary. I think it's early development of this kind of position across the state. I would imagine that any director would have both administrative as well as recovery clinical service responsibilities, those kinds of things. And again, just as Bryce mentioned earlier, where that person is placed in the organization would be critical. So if that's something that you all are thinking is desirable for your agency, I'm sure Pat and I and Tom Tro would be more than happy to sit down with you and discuss what your intentions are and how best to achieve that.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Nanette, and I think Jordan is probably, you know, given you all you need, Nancy, particularly being Region 4, and Jordan and Pat and Tom would be your go-to people for that. I think just, for the broader listening audience to know that I'm aware of at least one other organization in the state of Illinois that does have a person in that position. And so we do have resources on hand. So certainly either, your region recovery support specialist or having someone contact my office, because we can certainly assist with that. And this is, it's something that I think is really important. I think it's beyond just the ideological phase. It's not just like a good idea. I think it's something that we've heard and seen from other states in terms of the evolution of all of this, and recognizing the importance of essentially, if you're going to say this is where our organization is headed, that you really do position the organization to prepare for that in an equal kind of way. And I think, Bryce probably might want to speak to even how the collaborative has designed its departments like that to reflect that. So,
well, thank you. And I think I would primarily, echo what Jordan and Nanette have already said. One thing that I really encourage, whether you're looking for a director of recovery support or for recovery support specialist providing direct services, is I like to use the CRSS credential for core domains as essentially the outline or the lens, glasses, that I look through at a candidate for a certain well-roundedness. And those four domains are advocacy, mentoring, professional responsibility, and recovery support. And so as I look at a resume, I'm looking at it through those lenses. And as I interview a candidate, I'm asking them to tell me about an experience in advocacy where they've either advocated for someone or helped them to learn to advocate for themselves. In mentoring, I think this is one that would really apply well to a director of recovery. One mentoring person served, but have they had an opportunity to mentor other people on more of a professional basis, and so forth and so on. So I encourage using the credential in some ways as an outline for interpreting that. But qualifications, I think typically at a director level position, most often you would have bachelor's level or above. But I think certainly, as Jordan said, at least having the CRSS credential is very important. So thank you. And again, I think in our organization, you know, it serves us well having someone in that role to direct the staff. I think it makes a difference having someone in that leadership position who has done the work of self-disclosure before and navigated that process and the challenges of it, you know, to be able to mentor staff into how to do that effectively. So thank you.
Our next question comes from Tiffany.
Welcome to the call.
Thank you. You know, I actually, my question was answered in an earlier question from someone else, so thank you.
Oh, that's okay. Thanks for calling in.
Our next question comes from Ann Setson.
Welcome to the call.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. I'm here with Barbara Kendall as well. To begin with, I'd really like to express the gratefulness that HRC has for a recent in-service training that was provided by Nanette and Pat. It was a recovery-oriented training that really targeted our ongoing effort to integrate all of our services for outpatients. So that was an excellent in-service, and it was very helpful for our staff. I believe that it targets the sustainability of the program. Next, I wanted to talk about the ways that we measure success of our peer support services. We have several things we do. One is that we directly survey our consumers and ask for their feedback each time they visit. It's a choice, but we do ask for that. We have more consumers every month for our Consumer Advisory Council, and we openly ask for their feedback. The third is we have recently asked all of our staff members to begin collaborative documentation, and we ask directly, you know, the consumer's response to the services. Another thing we do is semi-annual program evaluations and utilize as much data as we possibly can to see how well we're doing. One specific example for our program is how many hospital deflections did we have each month. We also track the number of unduplicated consumers. And, of course, we look at the growth personally. And finally, every six months we do how are we doing surveys and include every one of our direct service providers to get direct feedback from the consumers.
That is all very impressive, Ann. Thanks for sharing, and Barb as well. Pat, would you like to respond?
Thanks, Bryce. Would you be able to kind of maybe give a summary or repeat it? I was having a little bit of trouble here.
Oh, okay. I apologize for the volume on our end. So they were sharing how at HRC they do surveys and they look at hospital reentries and other pieces of data. They do collaborative documentation and have just a number of different ways that they get consumer feedback on the value and of the recovery support program. So I was just asking if you could respond to those things.
Sure. I think getting consumer feedback is very important. I think a lot of the studies that are done nationally are showing more of that and showing the outcomes more. I think in the past, the national data has been more on, like, peer satisfaction surveys, peer specialists that work at organizations, their satisfaction. But now I think there's getting a lot more feedback from consumers of what they think of services and the outcomes. And I think that's not only helpful for nationally, but I think it's helpful for the agencies that are doing that in a lot of ways. Thanks.
Thank you so much. And there's so many ways that we can then use that information. One is, you know, for our own ongoing quality improvement, that we use that survey data and all the other data that you mentioned there at HRC to improve the way we do things, build upon our strengths. Another, I think, is sort of, to use it for marketing, for lack of a better term. And I think we can look at marketing from a few different angles. One is sort of marketing the program within the organization. I think anytime you develop a recovery support program or any other new program, for that matter, you're going to have some staff that are on board from day one and other staff that might be a little more skeptical about, okay, how is this working and what's the value of this? And so using some of those data for a report within the organization, I think, can be helpful. Also to advertise the program within the community as well. And finally, as we talked about earlier, sort of marketing the value of what you're doing to the Division of Mental Health and other funding sources to be able to show how effective the program is. And I think, taking a thorough look at marketing and who all do we need to market this program to can really help the program to be sustained. And also looking at, okay, so we have different options. We can put out a poster, we can put out a brochure, we can put out a long report. And so what sort of medium do we want to use for which audience? And so, obviously folks out in the community, aren't most likely going to be looking to read a whole report, maybe a poster or a brochure or something like that. But then, say, reporting to the DMH, you might want to have more of a thorough report. And so, those are just sort of some of the creative ways that you can look at different opportunities to promote what you're doing. And, we just want to promote what you're doing there at HRC. I think you've really made a lot of progress and been a standout organization with employing recovery support specialists and advancing a recovery support program. So thank you.
Thank you.
Moderator, any other questions or comments at this time?
Yes, our next question comes from Ken Polkey.
Hey, welcome to the call.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for all the kind words. I'm also with the Human Resources Center of Edgar and Clark Counties, and my comment is to give a little bit more of an overview of where I think agencies, when they're either developing or trying to expand their peer programs, should go. And that is to not just try to piecemeal things in this day and age. It's easy to get caught up with the crisis of the week, but look at a longer-term view and get as many people among the governing body and staff and looking at your long-term vision. What we have is what we call our 2020 vision strategy, and that has nothing to do with visual acuity. It's the year 2020 that we're looking at. And we picked the year 2020 because it's a little safer for some of us, shall we say, more experienced people that plan to be retired by then. So we take the personalities out of it, and we look at what do we want to see. And what we have in our vision for 2020 is to have 7 peer recovery support specialists and 7 therapists on the mental health side. So it provides hope to the therapists as well as the peers that they're going to be around, that we're going to need to expand the program elements, and to talk about having someone involved in a director position among the recovery programming. That's what we see, too. At the point where we have 7 peers, clearly we like to have a director-level recovery-oriented individual who has that firsthand recovery experience leading the way. But the bottom line is we get distracted by so many things as administrators and direct care staff trying to get through the day that it's easy to not realize that there is a larger vision, and that vision needs to be communicated to all of the staff. And that way those minor destruction activities like not having cash or not having everything you want for the week doesn't ruin the thinking that peer recovery programs are really going to be a larger and larger part of our future. When you look at the combination of the integrated care models that are going to be required, case coordination and integration of behavioral health and primary health care. I can't think of a better way to move in that direction but through peer recovery staff as a big component of it. So I encourage administrators and others to not just slap on a peer recovery element to their programming, but to look at where they really want to be somewhere down the line and then kind of reverse engineer that back to how do we get there.
Wow, thank you so much, Ken. Some really visionary thoughts there. We appreciate that. Jordan, would you like to respond to Ken's remarks about how they're doing the 2020 visioning process and some of his other remarks?
Well, I was listening to Ken, and I just couldn't agree with him more. I think, Ken is an example of a chief executive officer with true leadership, and, he is absolutely correct. We, the vision, the state is going through tough financial times right now. Everybody's worried about money, and the antidote to those concerns or the destructiveness of those concerns is really to have a vision and to be able to look towards the future. And as I mentioned earlier, that was the same thing we were doing with this other agency that's talking about hiring or developing a director of recovery services position. Unless you embed this and plan for it in the future, you're not going to be successful. And Ken's agency has made a statement about this, saying to people, you all are going to be around for a while. There's going to be a career path for you. Where our agency is committed, and I couldn't think of a better way to send those messages than this 2020 vision he has.
Thank you so much, Jordan. Great response, and thanks, Ken, for calling in. Perhaps if there's one more person in line, we could have time for one more question or comment.
Bryce.
Moderator, do we have one more in line?
No further questions.
Bryce, I had one comment if I could add to Ken's question.
Sure, that would be great. Thanks, Pat.
I wanted to mention that one of my coworkers, Tom Tro, the Region 3 Recovery Support Specialist, him and I have had a conversation about the recovery director position before, and he also thinks, that the title could be, another title could be recovery team leader, just because of the way that a director might lead to more of a hierarchical relationship. And I just wanted to restate one of my comments, which was that having a director, a recovery team leader, a recovery director, I think it's important because sometimes when you're working in as a group, as peers, and complicated, issues or questions come up, it's helpful to have somebody, whether it would be the recovery director or that can go to somebody if it is a complicated question that might be out of the expertise of the peers. So, and then when the group has somebody that they can direct their questions to and their concerns, and they know that team leader or that director will either handle it themselves or take it to somebody who can handle it, and I think that's an important part of it.
Well, thanks. Great remark, Pat. And with that, we want to say that, of course, we appreciate your involvement so much in this call, Jordan and Pat, also Trinda, Nanette, and also we're grateful to our partnership with Provider Relations at the Collaborative and for all their support with these webinars. We appreciate your feedback. We would ask that you would please complete the webinar survey at the end of this training that should pop up on your screen. And then we really want to emphasize that you may also send additional questions that you might have and a CEU sign-in sheet or request to trinda.hedges@valueoptions.com. Again, that's trinda.hedges@valueoptions.com. And the fax number there is 217-801-9189. Again, we're so grateful for everyone's participation and the completion of, I think, a great series. It's made great by just all the interaction that we've had with you all out there. And we just want to encourage you that just because the webinar is over doesn't mean that you know, our support of you is over. We have listed some contact information there for you, particularly through the regional recovery support specialist. We want to continue to build relationships and networks across the state and region to continue to advance recovery support services. And Nanette, would you like to share anything in addition?
Well, one thing I just wanted to say, we've highlighted and plugged the Peer Mentorship Learning Collaborative quite a bit during today's session, for which I hope and believe that Jordan and Pat and Tom are grateful. But that being said, I also just had this kind of almost afterthought, reminding myself that there is a protocol that they have for participation in that learning collaborative. And so I don't know, Jordan, if you would like to mention that on the line here before we adjourn.
Sure, I'd be happy to. We, Tom and I, have had the practice of an orientation session with any agency who's new to either joining either the peer-only call or the all-staff call, at which time we, you know, we take a little bit of time to talk about the history and the ways that people participate and talk about the differences between the two different calls and answer any questions. It takes a half an hour or less. That's just something we would like people to do who are new to the call so they can contribute in the most productive way. So the way that all they would need to do is contact Tom, myself, or Patrick. He helps out with these orientations as well. It could be as short as 15 minutes, maximum a half an hour, and desire to participate is the requirement, and otherwise after the orientation you're in.
Well, thank you very much, Jordan. I think those are important points. Amy, is there anything that you'd like to say to close us out?
Yes, thank you, Bryce. If there are no more questions in the queue, then that will conclude our call for today. I would like to remind the audience that today's call audio and PowerPoint will be posted under the Provider Resources heading on the Provider Information page of the Collaborative's website. That will be in MP3 format for download within 2 to 3 business days. I would also like to remind everyone that we value your feedback, so please take a few minutes to complete the brief survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum today. And Angela, please push the speakers through to post-conference, and you may now disconnect the main line.
This concludes today's conference. Please disconnect at this time.